It's May 21st, 2008. I'm Will Pratt, and I'm interviewing Art Sato about his experiences in the Army Service Corps and his experiences as a child in the Vancouver and internment camps. So we start with the very beginnings. What's your full name and your date of birth?
Arthur Hitoshi, H-I-T-O-S-H-I, Sato, S-A-T-O. Born 29th of April 1934, Vancouver, B.C.
Right. And where were your parents from then? A little bit.
My father was from Yamagata, Japan, and my mother, Pittsburgh.
Okay. Was your mother of Japanese descent as well?
Nobody believes me.
She doesn't seem like someone from Pittsburgh.
My mother was born in Pittsburgh in 1910, January, of a German mother and a Japanese father. And the Japanese father was from Niigata. Okay. N-I-I-G-A-T-A. Niigata.
So, what was your father's occupation then?
He was a grocery salesman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And when did he come over to Canada?
I think it was about 1910, in the 20s. In the mid-20s,
okay.
He came over.
And then he ran a grocery store in Vancouver?
No, he was employed by somebody.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And he would take these groceries and he'd deliver them, and he was a parcel salesman.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you have any siblings?
I have a sister, who is Mrs. Esther Etherly, who is now lives in Florida.
Okay.
78 years old.
Right. And so you lived in Vancouver then when you were growing up?
Vancouver. My parents were divorced in 1937-38. And my mother got custody of my sister and my father got me. Because he had to go to work, I was living with a group of I was placed in the custody of Catholic nuns.
Oh, okay.
On Cordova Street in Vancouver.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And what was that like growing up with the nuns?
Very regimented.
Yeah. Pretty strict.
Very strict.
Right.
You did things at a certain time. Mm-hmm. You went to bed at a certain time. Ate at a certain time. Prayed a lot.
Yeah.
Naturally.
Of course.
Right. You know, but they were good. I loved them all.
Yeah.
Really, they were very good, yeah.
And when you were young then, did you go to the public schools or was it a Catholic
school? Went to Strathcona School in Vancouver.
Okay.
Then during the war, Sacred Heart School in Greenwood. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Japan. I attended a Japanese school very briefly, but it didn't turn out so good. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going to St. Joseph's College in Yokohama. And that's why it's an American school, and I graduated from there.
So you were part of a Japanese-Canadian community then, would you say, in Vancouver, when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. But even though I wasn't the only one living with the sisters. There's quite a few people.
Right.
Yeah. Living with, and we were all part of yes, part of the Japanese-Canadian community.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you do any Japanese language schooling?
Yes. Yeah. We would go to Strathcona School, and then from 3:30, I think it was, till 5 o'clock, we attended the Japanese school. And oddly enough, the principal of that school was a person by the name of Sato.
Oh, okay.
Sato Kocho, we used to call him. Yeah. You know, he adopted a daughter from Japan. And that girl married Ray Nakamura. No, Ray Nakamoto. Remember Nakamoto?
Yeah. So then, what were your relations? Did you experience any racism or racial tension then when you were growing up in Vancouver?
Well, I was too small to realize something along those lines.
Right. And then so at what point in time did you say that your father and you were separated when you were quite young?
Yes, this was in 1942 when the Maoris came and took them and placed them into a camp in Alberta,
right.
And I was with the sisters, the Catholic sisters.
Right.
This was early 42, possibly February, March, around there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you remember the Mounties coming to get your dad?
Well, they just came and got him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they took him, and afterwards they found out, oh, wait a minute, hey, something's going wrong. They said, that he's got a young boy there in Greenwood, and we got him here. So they let him go. And I think we were reunited late summer of 42.
Okay.
Just in time for me to go to catch the fall term of school.
Right.
Yeah.
So in 42 then, your father would have left, and then you were with the nuns. And then in the fall of that year, or the summer, you went to Greenwood?
No, it was in February, March of that year, 42, the sisters went to Greenwood.
Right.
And I stayed with the sisters all during this time.
Gotcha.
Until my father showed up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And then, do you remember the actual particulars of going to Greenwood with the sisters then?
The only thing I remember is getting on that train. And the sisters were with us, and getting off, and then going over to up the big hill where the sisters had a house there.
Right.
And that's about all I remember of that trip.
Right. You would have been about 8 years old or so. Or?
Yes, about eight.
And do you? I imagine you were too young to remember the actual announcement of the Pearl Harbor bombing, or do you remember?
Don't remember that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I do remember the ending of the war. I remember that.
Right.
Yeah. Because it was in August,
yeah.
And I was fishing down by the creek.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the siren went, and it just kept on going.
Yeah.
And I was just going, I kept looking around, I couldn't see any smoke or anything. I said, I wish that stupid siren would stop. I couldn't understand it.
Right.
So finally, I brought in my line, and I went up to the main street there, and that's when I found out that Germany has lost the war.
Right.
The pubs opened up, we had one pub, and it was just jam-packed with people.
Yeah.
Just all white people, of course.
Yeah.
And of course, the Japanese came home from the logging camp and all those, and everybody was crying and all that sort of thing. But what the heck, it was over.
Yeah.
It didn't mean too much to me, really.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. You were young enough, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, your father, you say, went to Alberta, and he was on a road camp there? What was he doing?
He was doing, he was either at a road camp or he worked on a farm. One of the two.
Right.
But I'm not too sure just what he did.
Right.
He never spoke about that.
No. Okay.
Have some grapes.
So, what was the accommodation like where you were living in Greenwood?
You mean with the sisters?
Yeah. They had a convent kind of thing all set up.
The sisters slept on one side of the building and we slept on the other side. And there was about, when we got to Greenwood, there was me and about four or five other children.
Right.
But by the time the summer was over, I was gone, and the other two kids were gone, and we were, the sisters were on their own.
And where did you go, when you say you were gone, where did you go? Into a different house?
Well, my father came back.
Right.
So we're living in a building now.
Oh, okay.
On our own.
Gotcha.
And that's how it came about.
Mm-hmm. And what did you guys do in Greenwood then? Did you have duties?
My father was the first guy to secure permanent employment. And he worked for a Ukrainian guy in a lumber camp. They would leave Sunday afternoon and be back Saturday, the following Saturday. And the only thing I required was that somebody cook for me. And he would find somebody for that.
Right. So you would just go to a local family's then and have meals with them?
I'm sorry?
You would go to a local family and have meals with them?
No. My father struck a deal, an agreement, with one of the ladies. And she would cook for me.
Right.
And Jenny make sure that, you know, I got home, you know, and doing all those things.
Right.
Yeah.
And was it, do you remember any construction activities or anything like
I'm
that?
Sorry?
Do you remember any buildings being constructed
no.
while you were there or anything
no.
like that? And was your, would you say your lodging with your father, was it adequate for the cold winter months? Do you remember
no.
the winters?
It was terrible.
It was terrible, yeah.
We were living in a hotel.
Yeah.
On the third floor. They took the name away, and they just called it a building by number. Building number one, number two, number three, number four. We were in building number four on the third floor. And there was one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, 9, 10 families on that one floor, one toilet. And if you don't think that was rough.
And then for most of the time while you were in Greenwood, then you would have been going to school?
The Catholic nuns run the school,
right.
Sacred Heart School.
Right.
And it went up to grade 8.
Mm-hmm.
And once you passed grade 8, you went to the public school. That's where all the white kids were.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was a different culture altogether. Even within the confines of Greenwood, you were so insulated in that one culture with the Sacred Heart School, with all the Japanese kids. And then you passed grade 8, and you went over to the other side, and there were all these white kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was kind of strange in
right.
that way,
right.
you know. But fortunately, we had a very good mayor, Mayor MacArthur.
Did you have any contact with a gentleman? I understand that he organized his chapel to move to Greenwood. His name was Father Benedict Quigley. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had to be one of the nicest fathers, priests, that he didn't come to Greenwood.
Okay.
He was the priest for the Catholic Sisters, Franciscan priest, in Vancouver. And he would take us kids to Stanley Park, you know, on Saturdays.
Wow, I tell you, that was a treat. Bye. God, that was a treat.
Yeah.
Father Quigley did not come with us to the internment camp. And I think, you know, what happened to him was that he had philosophical differences with his society, mm-hmm. and he left the priesthood, as I understood it.
Right. Right.
That's the way I understood it. I don't know.
And was there mostly Catholics in Greenwood then, in terms of Japanese Canadians, or
the ones that went to Sacred Heart? Yeah,
yeah.
Quite a, well, not mostly, but quite a few.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was there Catholic and Protestant denominations, or the two churches? In
not that I'm aware of. Just the Catholics were predominant.
Just Sacred Heart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Come here, dog. And so what happened then? You mentioned the end of the war. What happened after the war then? Were you still in Greenwood at that time?
We were still in Greenwood in 1945 when the announcement came through. The Japanese and Japan had lost the war. Everybody started to wonder what was going to happen. Well, that decision came down pretty quick, within a year. And that's when we found out about, we were given three choices, you know. Number one, we weren't allowed to return to the West Coast. Number two, we can go east of the Rockies and they'll pay for it. The government will pay for it. And number three, we could stay where we are. Who wants to do that? Or go to Japan. And my father offered for Japan.
So when did you go to Japan then?
October of 1947, on board the USS Marine Falcon. It's strange, you know, that I would remember such a thing like that. You know?
Yeah.
And my mother asked me later, he said, did you and your father leave the train and were you walking along the railroad depot there on Vancouver, you know? I said, no, we weren't allowed. We had to get off the train and get on board the ship.
Because you were still prohibited from being in...
That's right, we weren't allowed to,
Right. I should ask you too, what was your mother doing during this time? She was separated from your father, but what was she up to?
She made a housing. You know what a housing is?
No.
It's a white person.
Oh, right.
Yeah. She made a housing, had two sons, had something about her name, Smith. She didn't go into the camp. She didn't go into the internment camp.
Right.
She was allowed to stay in Vancouver and work in the post office,
right?
Well, Mom had it right. Yeah, Mom had it good.
And did you have much contact with her while you were in the internment camp?
No. I didn't even know I had a mother until I got to Japan.
So you went across then in 47, did you say?
October 47.
47?
Yeah.
And then what was Japan like when you got there? What were your first impressions?
When I got to Yokohama, we could see from the ship, I could see a couple of Quonset huts here and there, you know.
Right.
But for all intents and purposes, it was all bombed out. Yokohama, Osaka, Yokohama, Tsurumi, Kawasaki, Tokyo, all that corridor there was all bombed out.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of destruction.
So, a lot of destruction,
And I assume there was a lot of American servicemen still around.
Yeah, some of the nicest guys I met there, they were quite sympathetic towards us, The people left us alone.
Right.
A lot of us guys found jobs with them because of our language, Like my dad speaks some of that, So he was allowed to, he worked at the U.S. Naval Base there.
Right. What was he doing there?
I don't know what he was doing. He was some sort of an administrator, I guess.
And to yourself, you went to school?
St. Joe's College, yeah. Right. Initially, when I got there, after our status was established, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said to my father that, you're reestablished here in Japan. He says, but the boy, you didn't register him in Vancouver with the with the Japanese consulate. So, see, my name was not on the Koseki Doho. So I was treated as a foreigner. Ironic, really, when you look at it. But the thing about being a foreigner in Japan was that I was entitled to certain rations. Canned goods, fruit, salt, sugar, tea, coffee, So my stepmother would get that and swap, She was a good horse trader.
Right?
Yeah.
So did you have to line up for goods and stuff like that, or was it a fairly normal...
You lined up for everything in Japan in those days. Until the Korean War started, then things got a little better by that time. Right. And it's so sad, you know, when you stop to think of it, that one nation's prosperity is contingent upon another country's war. You know, they were bringing the trucks and the armored vehicles all into Japan for repairs instead of doing it there and then shipping it right back again. Instead of taking it all the way back to the United States and getting new stuff,
right.
It was all done like, hey, you know, this is what's for the economy going.
Right.
You know.
When you left to Japan, did you leave with people you knew from Canada as well? Were there other Canadians?
There were some, yeah, some I knew, yeah.
Did you keep in touch with them in Japan?
No.
No.
Unfortunately, no. Because once we got to Japan, we went to different places.
Right.
Some, well, we stayed pretty well close to where we landed, mm-hmm. Yokosuka, Yokohama. Some others went to Wakayama. Some went to, I don't know where they went to, really. They just spread out. Yeah.
And so you went to high school then, there in Japan. And what prompted you to return to Canada then?
What's that?
How did you end up back in Canada then? And, what happened in between those times?
Went to the embassy.
Right.
And I said, I wanted to know what I had to do to go back to Canada. And then I found out, he said, because of the Canadian Citizenship Act, I was forced to come to Japan, and because of this, they were going to pay my way back. Kick us out, and now they're going to pay us way back. Oh, God. You know, anyway, didn't have any money, don't have a job, don't have a place to stay. We suggest you join the Canadian Army. That's how I got it.
So when you joined the Army, were you in Japan?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
The Korean War was just about winding down at that time, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And so how did that work? You went to Canadian Army group that was already in Japan and signed up there? Or?
There was a place in near Kure. That's where the British were. And that's because of that, the Canadians were there, Australians were there, and the New Zealanders were there.
Right.
There was a unit called the 2nd Canadian Administrative Unit.
Right.
And I was told to go there, and they will process me. So that's what happened. I went there, and they looked at all my documents. They processed me. I think it was within 3 days.
Right. You know, you were saluted.
Take the Bible in your left hand and raise your right arm.
Okay,
gotcha. So I artists and everybody, you know, Northern Ireland and all that sort of thing.
So when you were... did you have a job to do right away then when you were in Japan, or did you just come across Canada?
Because I was able to type. They kept me at the 2CAU,
yeah.
And it kept me working there.
Right?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
And about what year would this be when you signed up?
I got there in the last part of July 1953.
Yeah.
I was enrolled on the 3rd of August.
Right.
53.
So this is the period of the Korean War then. Did you go to Korea itself?
No.
No? Okay. And what were you hearing about the Korean War while you were in Japan? I guess you would have seen a lot of the soldiers that had been over there in Japan at that time.
What's that?
In the 50s. From 1950 to 53, when you were in Japan, what were you seeing about of the soldiers that were in Korea?
You mean guys coming back from Korea?
Yeah.
I didn't see too many. But I do remember seeing a lot of Marines, U.S. Marines, right? And, you know, I think about those, you know, I still remember, walking towards the railroad station, and there were a couple of Marines and sailors behind me, and they were walking up, going to the train station, and from the opposite direction, there was this ex-Japanese Army veteran coming, and he was dressed in whatever, white or something, and he had this container, and it was full of his Army buddy's ashes. You know, he was like this, but you didn't have to be told what it was. You know, you could immediately say, and you know, those Marines, American Marines and sailors, they stopped. They made a left turn. Mm-hmm. They saluted.
Yeah.
That's what I saw. Something, but I didn't see too many wounded soldiers coming. They were, those who were serious were immediately evacuated back home to Canada or to the United States. Mm-hmm. And those who were not so bad went into the hospital first, and then after they were pronounced okay, then they, I think they were shipped home then. But I never did come in contact too much with them.
Right. You know. And did you see any of the Canadians from Korea that were on leave in Japan, or do you run into them? And
yes, saw quite a few of them.
Right.
The Vandus.
Yeah.
All those Vandus.
Yeah.
They're crazy, boy. I'm dying. Yeah. And quite a few of the RCRs and PCLI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were their reactions to you as a person that looked, you know, like a
Japanese? Well, a lot of them, strangely enough, were not aware of what it was.
Right.
They knew something. They knew something, but they weren't really fully aware of the full facts.
Right.
You know, oh, yeah, I heard something about that. So you were one of those guys that was, went to some kind of a camp or something? That's what was all, you know. And although there was some who knew.
Yeah.
And once they found that I was interned, you know, it seemed to me that to be enrolled within 3 days, you know, that's just a very short time, you know. But that's what it was, 3 days.
Yeah.
So maybe they sort of rushed things for me, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
So after your services there in Japan itself, when did you come back to Canada?
August of 1954.
Okay.
Landed in the Victoria, Vancouver International, and mother was there.
Yep. So you met your mother?
Yeah, my mother was there with her husband and the two boys.
Right.
And they just, she gave me, got to remember, it's in 37, 38. 16 years since I've seen her.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And there she was, gave me a nice big hug.
Yeah.
You know, and took me home.
Right.
And there I stayed there for a while.
Yeah.
You know, those two kids that were just 4 or 5 years old. Did you bring back any Korean War dead with you? Where's your rifle?
So, were you already in the service corps then at this time, or so you entered right into the service corps? Right?
Yeah, and then that fall, I went to Camp Borden in Ontario for my training.
Right, pretty basic. Yeah.
Yeah, my basic.
Right on. And what was that like?
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked it very much.
Yeah.
We were on the way. It was winter, and it was cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. But it was good. I liked it. Yeah.
Right. And were you treated equally as anyone else?
Yeah.
You didn't experience any troubles?
I come across three Australians, and they fought against the Japanese.
Right.
But you see, the reason why they joined the Canadian Army was because they had Japanese wives. And they couldn't take them into Australia, because Australia had that policy of white-only policy.
Huh.
So that's why they couldn't stay in Japan, they couldn't read or write Japanese, could get a job. So coming into, you know, into the Canadian Army was the next best thing.
Yeah. And what unit then were you posted to when you came back here?
I was at Jericho Beach.
Okay.
Headquarters, British Columbia area, BC area. Yeah, Jericho Beach.
And you were doing administration then? So then this is getting up to the time that you were deployed overseas in Egypt. Is that correct?
57.
57, right on.
We were the second group to go in.
Right on.
Yeah.
So what had you heard then of Nasser's rejection of the Queensland Rifles, for example, or what did you know?
The Queensland Rifles were supposed to go over, and they were stopped at... Where were they stopped? Someplace. They were stopped somewhere because Nasser would not agree to... You see, he didn't want anything to do with the British. And one of those was the Queen's Own Rifles of Canada.
Right.
He didn't like that.
Right.
So he said no. But he said, the rest can come.
Right.
You know? And if you're an individual soldier, you can come. But not the battalion as such.
Right.
You can go.
So it was the service elements that ended up going in. And did you say you were a second rotation of the...
We were the second group to go in.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. And this would have been in 58?
No, 57. 57. The first group to go in was 56,
right.
Just after the war.
Right.
Yeah.
And so where... how did you get there, for one?
Flew. Went by train from... Vancouver to Montreal on the airplane, RCAF from Montreal to Gander, from Gander to Azores, Azores to Naples, Naples to Ellerish.
That's quite the trip.
Train, DC-9, and a boxcar.
Yeah.
You know what those boxcars are? Eh? They're the most noisiest damn things you ever... You've been in them, haven't you?
Never been.
Jesus.
So, did you go over with members of the administrative unit from Vancouver then, or were you just...
No, I was... most of us were just one-on-one...
Replacements.
Yeah.
Right.
I went there, one guy came home.
Right.
You know, so that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. And where were you stationed? In
Gaza.
Gaza.
Right in Gaza.
Right.
Yeah.
Up north there. Right on. And what was the, was the, it a mixed base or was it all Canadians together? Or
no, it was a mixed base.
Right.
I worked for an Indian subedar. I worked for two Indian officers. Isn't it strange that I still remember their name and the initials?
Yeah.
Major J.C. Honda, Major K.S. Chingota.
Yeah.
Funny how I remember those names.
Right.
But then again, you know, these Indian officers, you know, they're all British training. They follow the British system, you see.
Right.
And so you can, so does Canada. So you can pretty well gauge yourself. I had no use for the Brazilians or the Colombians.
Just didn't get along?
No, No. The staff officers, they didn't make good staff officers. That's why I'm concerned.
Right.
Yeah. And you never saw them. You saw them once every now and then in Blue Moon. Yeah. But the Indian Army officers, they were all there every time.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So these Indian officers were the heads of the logistics section of it, the Service Corps element, or?
Oh, you mean when I was to Egypt?
Yeah.
No, I was with the personnel section.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. See, Major Singota, Major Honda, they were majors in the Indian Army, but they were also staff officers, and they handled personnel matters. Within the UN organization, and I was one of your corporal administrators.
Right.
Yeah.
So, what What other UN contingents were there then?
There were Canadians. There were Danish, Norwegians, Swedish, Yugoslavs, Brazilian, Colombians, right. Finns. There was one more group, Indonesians. But they went home very quickly because of the, you know, Sukarno or whatever it is. They're having problems back home. So they sent you back home.
Right.
Just a minute, I want to show you something.
Yeah. So you had contact then with all these international elements in the base?
Oh, you mean, did I have contact with
yeah.
them? Well, each contingent sent a couple of men to work at the headquarters building.
Right.
We had a couple of Colombians and Brazilians, which I had no use for.
Yeah.
We had Norwegians and Danes and Finns and Swedes as well. But I have to admit, the people I got on most best were Canadians. Yeah. Most probably because of the communications gap.
Right.
You know. We had a hot bunked in the same room as a Norwegian guy. His name was Anderson. And that's all I know about him.
Yeah.
That his name was Anderson, that he came from Norway. And that's all I knew of him.
Yeah.
He didn't even want to talk in English. Just that's the way he was, you know.
So there was a lot of communications problems then, you would say?
Well, I didn't have any communication problem. I sort of, by gesturing, you know, But, you know, it's very hard to satisfy a different nationality, you know, especially in the kitchen, especially in the mess hall, you know. Brazilians and Colombians would complain that there's not enough rice, which I thought was strange, you know. But they are basically rice eaters, believe it or not. They eat a lot. Swedes, Norwegians, they're fish and potato eaters, you know. Yugoslavs, well, they'll eat anything out here. But the man I worked for was a Yugoslav. He was a lieutenant colonel. And I asked him one day, I said, Colonel, have you ever met the president? He said, yes. Good friend of mine. Yes. We go to war, during the war, against Germany, he said. You know what his name was?
Yeah.
Tito.
Yeah. Right.
You know Tito?
Right.
Yeah.
So, did you have contact then with the local Egyptians?
Only those who worked for us.
Right.
Guys who worked in the canteen, guys who worked in the mess hall, guys who were runners.
Right.
This sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you have time to leave while you were there? And how did you spend that?
UN gave us 15 days. I got pictures of that. I went straight up to the pyramid.
Right.
And down below,
of course. Yeah.
Got $700 when I was there. Something about, I don't know, got diarrhea anyway.
Yeah. And what was the weather like?
Hot, very hot in the summer.
Yeah.
Cold, very cold in the winter. Didn't rain too much, but it was cold.
And did you think, while you were there, what did you think of UN peacekeeping? Because that was the first one.
I'm not a historian, I'm not a politician.
Okay.
But even as young as I was, back then, within 2 months, I knew that we can come back there 20 years from then, and the place would still be the same. And I was right. For change, I was right. They're still having the same problems.
Yeah.
The Palestinians do not have their homeland.
And this is wrong. It should.
So, is there anything else about your stay in Egypt that you remember that's worth...
Okay.
Is there any other memories from Egypt that you'd like to mention before we move on?
I was always hungry. Poor. Laundry facilities was poor. Other than that, given the circumstances, we weren't allowed really contact with the local people.
Right.
Especially the women.
Right.
Bad.
Yeah. What was the canteen situation there? Was there a lot of drinking? Or?
We made use of that gang.
Yeah.
we out-drank it every night.
Yeah.
Nothing else to do.
Right.
See. But in the main camp, Camp Rafa, where the Canadians were main located,
that was okay.
Yeah, you can get hamburger. Yeah, you can get toilet anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Was there sports and that kind of thing? Recreation?
Okay.
Did you do any sports or anything like that? Or recreation?
No. But I know that some of the Canadians in the main camp, they had a donkey. A jackass. A small one. And you know, the typical Canadian, they taught the donkey how to drink beer. Called the Moscow. And he got so used to drinking beer, he'd go from one group of soldiers, he'd wait until somebody gave him a beer, and take the helmet off, pour the beer in, give it to him, and then he was drinking. And he got so bad that one day he said, I don't mind giving this guy beer every now and then. This cheap jackass never even been around. Of course, we had our theft.
Right.
Yeah. We had our theft. Machine guns were stolen. And there was a Canadian. See, the only thing, they don't like dogs. A dog is an unclean animal. So this dog was trained by the Canadians. Sniff things out. I don't know how he did it, but they did it. So they got all the local help that was working in the animal compound, and they were stores, you know, armories. They all lined them up, single file, in two or three rows. And the dog would go up and down. And he would stop. Go up and down. Stop. Go up and down. And he did that two or three times. Each time he stopped with the same guy. And that's how they found out that it was these three guys who stole all these animals and what have you, and machine guns. And they got it back. I'll say that much, yeah. They got it back. Yeah.
And were there any fights or anything like that between UN contingents in those days? Any rough stuff?
No. I tell you, what separated Palestine, Egypt, from Israel was an imaginary line, a line, and was called the ADL, Armistice Demarcation Line. And each had strategic point, it would be manned by UN guards or Israeli guards. And we managed to get up to one of those points. We saw the Israeli soldiers, and we said, and they came over.
Yep.
And I still have pictures. There was three men and two women. And they were all paratroopers. And one of the girls spoke reasonably good English. And she just looked at me and she said, what are the Chinese doing here? you can't train Nisa, you know.
Was that pretty much it for Egypt memories then?
I'm sorry?
Do you remember anything else from Egypt you'd like to say?
I stayed there 1 year, finally came home.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Didn't want to go back there again.
Right. When you came back, were you back in Jericho Beach?
I went back to Jericho Beach.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't stand it. So in 50... I got back in September of 58, and 59, I asked for a transfer to Germany right away. I got it.
Yeah.
March of 1960, I was on my way again.
What didn't you like about Jericho there?
What's that?
What didn't you like about Vancouver?
What was it that I didn't like about it?
Yeah.
Nothing. You know, it's just itchy.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah, we just want to get out and go.
Right.
Yeah. So I managed to get to Germany.
Right on. So you went there in 1960 then?
60, March of 1960.
Yep.
Made to Germany. Yeah.
And were you a kind of another one-man switchover?
Yep.
And what was your reception into your unit then? In
not bad. Very good.
And yeah. What unit was it?
One transport company.
Right on.
Yeah.
Right on. And where were you stationed?
Zost. Place called Zost, Germany. The fort we stayed in was Fort Chambly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And was it exclusively Canadian, Fort Chambly?
Yeah, exclusively Canadian.
And what kind of facilities were set up there? Was it kind of full base facilities with?
Oh yeah.
Everything. Basically a small town.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a chapel.
Yeah.
Skating rink, of course.
Right.
Zamboni, of course.
Right.
Kids don't have their little arena. The Zamboni machine to go with it.
Right.
It just doesn't seem like that.
You played hockey back then?
No.
No?
No, but don't think I can do it. A training officer who was in charge of hockey program would come up and say, Corporal, he said, tonight you're at the rink and you'll be taking the money. That's as close as I can.
So, what was the accommodation like there in the
very good
barracks?
Well, of course, it was communal.
Oh.
You know, 10 guys down this way, 10 guys out. But I was a corporal, so I had a room for myself.
Right.
Yeah. And I had my own key and everything, you know. So that was not bad, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And were there, I understand there was families stationed there as well of the personnel. Was there wives and children and stuff like that in Sosk?
Yep.
Fortunately. Did you have contact with them?
Not that much.
Okay. Yeah.
Only after I got, only on my second tour.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, in your first tour then, did you listen, or in both tours, I guess, did you listen to Radio Canadian Army Europe and what was going on that, just kind of the local news back in Canada? Or,
yep. We also had a newspaper, it was called The Beaver.
Right.
How Canadian can you get The Beaver? So we kept news. Kept in touch that way.
Right.
Each morning we would have news, and of course we would have a popular music program, you know, and things of this nature.
Right.
They would do interviews, they would have play-by-play announcement on the hockey,
right.
And afterwards the obligatory interviews, you know, and all.
And so what did you do for enjoyment in your off hours then?
I was in touch with one of my cousins, and I went to various places. I went to Dortmund, I went to Frankfurt, I even went to England.
Right.
Well, that was when I was in Egypt.
Right.
But when I was there, there's plenty to do.
Right.
Of course, I had an outside second cousin. In Germany.
Oh, okay.
Remember I said earlier that my mother was born of a German mother and a Japanese father?
Right, yeah.
Well, my grandmother's youngest sister had a son. His name was Kurt. And it is, so he would be first cousins to my mother. And it was, I managed to get in touch with him and we got together. He says, you know, he said, I tried to immigrate to Canada. Very, very good. And he said, they won't accept my application. I said, why not? You know why? He was a pilot in the Luftwaffe doing the Second World War.
That's the reason why. That's what he told me. You know. But you know what his job was? He was too old, you know. So all he did was drive the pilot the airplane from Germany to Poland, to wherever they needed the most, jump the plane down there, catch the train back. That was his job. You know.
And how's the food then in Germany? How's the food there in Germany?
Well, the food in the at the army messes was good.
Yeah.
But the food with the Germans, nothing fancy, not exactly French style. Very heavy on the potatoes, and a very substantial meal. The Germans didn't believe in all this fancy cook. They believe in giving you the you know, the real government gift,
right?
My stepfather, my mother's husband, came over to Germany. And we took him to this restaurant called the Trucker's Restaurant, where they butchered their own meat and everything. And they brought the meat out. And you know, that boy, that man was raised on a farm in Birchill, Saskatchewan. And he grew up during the Depression. And even he couldn't finish what they put in front of him. It was just too much. But you know, the Germans, they all, you know, they go, yeah. He was very, very impressed with that. Yeah.
Did you have a lot of contact with the Germans then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. My wife is from Austria.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, she was what they call a guest worker in Germany.
Oh, okay. So yeah. You met her then?
Huh?
You met your wife
met her over there, yeah.
Through the Nandover Gate? Yeah. And what were your specific duties then when you were in
Germany? Field administration. Yes. Worked in the company orderly room.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was it personnel?
Personnel. Did just about everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything from typing orders, letters, filing, passport applications, and just about everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, in 1961, there was this big escalation of the Cold War with the Berlin Wall being built. Do you remember an enhanced sense of, caution during that time? Or
No.
No?
No.
Your first tour?
The only thing I remember is that second time when I went back to Germany, it was in August of 1968, and we landed in Dusseldorf on the 21st of August. 1968, and we stopped at this restaurant area, got out, stretch our legs, go to the bathroom, and a whole group of people there listened to the radio. So I asked, I told the wife, I said, go find out what's going on there. She came back, she said, the Russians just invaded Czechoslovakia. Wow. So we got the base camp, people were calling. It was a madhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about back in 62 with the Cuban Missile Crisis? Was that?
No, didn't affect me too much.
Didn't affect too much?
No.
Or the? Do you remember the assassination of JFK?
I was in Vancouver.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're back then.
Oh, I came back in 63. Yeah.
Okay. And what kind of contact with, how did you meet your wife then?
She worked in the officer's mess,
right,
as a waitress.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And she would drop by my office and pick up the menus or whatever it was.
Right.
Or I would see her. But prior to that, she used to work in a little pub downtown.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I initially met her.
Right.
And then she stopped that work and came to work in our camp.
Right.
And that's, and then that was in yeah, that was in the fall of 61. Yeah.
And did you get married?
60. Fall of 1960.
Yeah.
And we were married in August of 61.
Right.
Yeah. I did get married twice.
Over there and back home, or what?
No. See, we had to get married first by the German civil authorities, by the Bürgermeister,
right,
and then by the RC priest. Now, the trouble with that is that the Canadian Army did not recognize the marriage by the priest. And the church did not recognize the marriage by the local justice of the peace. Such a good man's choice. 10 o'clock in the morning, and then we just got on my Volkswagen and we went right straight, almost nonstop, to Vienna, Austria.
Right.
Got there about 10 o'clock in the night.
Right.
Oh, you made it.
So, is there anything else you'd like to note about your first tour then, with the British Army on the Rhine there?
How was that?
Any other memories that come to mind of that first tour then?
Oh. No.
You think the logistics situation was good for the Canadians?
What's that?
In terms of logistics for the 4th Canadian Infantry Brigade Group during that period, do you think they were fairly well?
Logistics?
Yeah.
We came out of the British. So most of the logistical support came from the British.
Okay.
All our rations, all our petrol,
right,
everything came from the British.
Right.
We paid for it.
Right.
Well, once we left the British, you see, the British controlled it called Northern Army Group, and it was called NORTHAG.
NORTHAG.
So when the decision was made that the Canadians would move down south and away from the Northern Army Group, because we were not British anymore, so
right,
we ended up with the Americans as backup, and it was with CENTAG, called Central Army Group. And that's how we got hit up. I don't know this. I didn't care for some of the rations that we got from the British. Americans were a lot better, for that matter, you know. But,
So, did you, was there a lot of buzz about the nuclear weapons during that period, about the Canadians and the Honest John tactical nuclear weapons?
Well, that would be artillery.
Right.
We didn't have too much to do with that at all. Yeah.
Was there a lot of news in the press about it at the time?
Yeah.
Not focus.
Yeah.
So, what then, you came back in 63, did you say? From your first tour?
My first tour, yeah.
Back
I got back in October 63.
Yeah.
And I went down to, I was back at Jericho Beach.
Yeah. And then you brought your wife with you when you came home?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember getting off at Trenton. Got on the bus, I got on the Volkswagen, and we traveled. 4 or 5 days later, we were still in Canada. And she said, "Are you sure we're still in Canada?" It was such a... if you drive back nonstop across Europe, you go through about 10 different countries.
Right.
You know?
So, for your second tour, were you just kind of getting antsy again then and wanted to break things up?
I didn't want to go.
Oh, you didn't?
No. I didn't want to go.
Right.
But they promised me housing, which was available when I got there, and I had a good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I stayed in the main mail room,
right,
called the Central Registry. And there's where I stayed for my whole 3 years.
Right.
And when the marching orders, when I got my marching orders, I asked for Vancouver, no. Chilliwack, no. Kamloops, no. And they were going to send me to Quebec. And I said, "No, I don't want to go to Quebec. I'd rather go to New Brunswick, Cape Town."
Ooh, you take me, no.
So tell me what we do. He said, "We'll take you to the Navy, Squamaw." So, so when I reported in to the base chief, you know, Flood Dival. I said, "Sir, I'm Sergeant Sato, just reporting in. Just turn from overseas." He said, "Your army, aren't you?" "Yes, sir." "I was a civilian cloak." "How do you know?" "Well, you see, in the Navy, You don't call a sir. Only a gun officer. But in the, you know, in the Canadian Army, you call a sergeant major, sir, and our saying, sir, God help you if you didn't. He said, well, you're Navy now. Petty officer, Sato. But you know that, I was there about 7 years.
Yeah.
Oh, best 7 years. Those Navy guys, real nice guys.
So, just getting back to your second tour in Germany, how would you compare it to your first? What were the differences?
Job-wise, I knew a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Knew what to be aware of. Housing was available. The kids were growing up. I had my three by then. Right. And everything had kind of more settled down.
So your family came with you then?
Yeah, family came with me, yeah.
So you were used to it by then?
Yeah, we got used to it, yeah. So we got back here, 71. We went down to Colorado and the wife, you know, she saw all this on there, you know, beautiful thing. She says, we're not leaving again.
Right.
But I got my marching order to go to sit in Suffield in Alberta. Okay. He told me, you go alone.
Yeah. Gave you the ultimatum. So,
yeah. Well, so I said, the kid, I had 24 in. And then we were beginning to put roots down. Bought the house. 73. Or 33. Imagine that. You can't even buy a good car for 33 now.
That's true.
Hey, I'm Jacob. Yeah. So anyway, they got my marching orders to go to Suffield, Alberta, and I said I would not accept, and they came back and said that I would have to superannuate. In other words, I got kicked up.
Right.
You know, but now, I'm crying out loud. They're screaming for guys to stay in. And they don't have enough people.
So that pretty much gets to the end of your career then. It was 78 you retired?
78. Nope. Actually, I left in 77, December of 77, but I had about 4 months of leave coming. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until April that I Chief Petty Officer that I worked for took me out, the whole staff took me out for lunch and dinner. And I got so freaking drunk, you know, they had to drag me up the stairs here. My bloody eyes are popping out because I was drunk. But they were nice guys. They were nice guys. I really liked them, yeah.
Yeah, enjoyed your time. Yeah. And what was your final rank when you retired?
Sergeant. I wanted to go to sea. And they said they do not take sergeant. They only take corporal, master corporal, or petty officer first class. Not petty officer second class or sergeant. They would not take it. So I volunteered, not accept. Right. So when I went to Suffield, even to one combat group in Calgary, is there promotion involved? No. Yeah, I'm not going. So, I mean, you just can't keep on turning down assignments like that. You know, they are going to nail you, you know.
So, throughout your career, then, would you say that you were held back by your Japanese origins?
Yeah.
Would you say that your Japanese Canadian citizenry, or being visible in the minority, held you back at all through your military career?
The only way I can answer that is by saying, I hope not. But there are times, you know, when it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, struts like a duck, then you got to say it's a duck. You know? So the God that I knew, when he came to me, he was a front corporal. He ended up a warrant officer, and I was still a sergeant. So you take it from there. Of course, now, sometimes in the mid-70s that when Brian Mulroney came in and brought in this multiculturalism, it's only then that things began to change. Now in the armed forces you get Asians, Orientals. I mean, you look at the police department in Abbotsford, East India, in Vancouver, Chinese. Mayor Lowe, Chinese. So things have changed quite a lot. But I could never convince that to my father. Yeah, he wouldn't come, no. I asked him if he'd like to come back and see for himself, and he said no.
So it wasn't pretty bitter then?
Well, I think he was bitter. He just said he's too old to travel.
Yeah.
So, and I sure remember. He walked me to the train station, bought a ticket that allowed them to just go to the platform, And he took me right to the door, gate, of the train.
And
he looked at me and he said, you know, when you were a boy, during the war in Greenwood, he said, you suffered a lot. And he just turned around and walked away. That's all I saw. Yeah, that's what he said to me in Japanese. お前あの戦争時代グリーンウォードで若い時に苦労した。I was stunned. You know, it's his way of saying, you know, that I had a rough time. You know, but I thought that was very nice of him. You know, so yeah. But he got married. He married a good woman. Fine woman. Yeah. Horse trader.
I think that pretty much comes to the end of it, unless there's anything else.
I ended up in the slammer.
In the slammer? Where is that?
Williamhead.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Right.
That's where all the ex-Navy guys end up, on the staff there,
Right.
Yeah. And I had a pretty good time there. Have you heard of, Steve, the watch times, time watch bandit, or called Steve something. Oh, Jesus. Anyway, he timed it. When he did his robberies in the United States, he had everything timed.
Oh, yes, yeah, stopwatch bandit.
Stopwatch bandit,
right.
Yeah. And I knew him. God, he's the nicest crook.
Nicest crook you ever met, eh?
He always says, how are you doing, Art? And they're looking after you. You just take it easy. And he timed everything. The key, he said, was timing. You have to study everything, time it, and once that time was up, regardless, you had to leave. That was the key to success. Like, oh, then, Ross, and he timed it. See? And if he hadn't got all the money, what the fuck do you leave anyway? And that's how he got away with it. And he ended up here, and then he ended up robbing some bank in town, remember? And that's how he got ended up in here. And here, he married that poet somewhere in Victoria. Yeah.
Jesse.
Well,
I think we can call that an interview. Thanks a lot, Art.